and verses 12 following through to 18. That's the reading that I want to particularly give attention to this morning. Gospel conduct. How we live our lives. I think that's the thrust. I don't know about your upbringings, but I suspect some of you were taught to pray. I was never taught to pray. I was taught to wish. That's what we did in my household as we grew up. You make a wish. You make a wish on a star. You make a wish on your birthday. You ask some unnamed entity to do what you want, to take an interest in what you want. Birthday candles, blowing out the birthday. Make a wish, make a wish. I remember a little rhyme that I was taught. Starlight, star bright, first star I see tonight. Wish I may, wish I might. Have the wish, I wish tonight. And when you see that first star rising in the sky, you'd make your wish. You can never just have a wish when you wanted, like pray. You can pray whenever you like. It was only when, you know, auspicious moments, a special day or a special event like the new first star of a new day. I had lucky stars. I grew up very superstitious. Magpies, the number of magpies and all that sort of thing. Very superstitious. And the truth is that I think generally human beings, their tendency is towards superstition, isn't it? We tend towards superstition. I still, when I think about it, I mean, I took my star signs quite seriously for years, and yet they're different in the different newspapers. That can't be right, can it? And yet you get drawn into this. You can get drawn into it as a sort of magnetism about it. And the ancient world was full of superstition, just like our world is today. And they worship stars. Like in Genesis, you know, when it says in Genesis chapter 1, and he made the stars. One of the really powerful things about that statement is that he's speaking to people who lived amongst people who literally worship the stars. You're not called to worship the stars. Worship the God who made the stars. That's how great our God is. He's greater than the other gods. We've been singing it, haven't we? Great over all the other gods. Don't worship the stars. Worship God who made the stars. God has used the stars. He made the stars for a purpose. Abraham looked up at the stars and God spoke to him, didn't he? As he looked at the stars, made prophecy to him as he looked up at the stars. And I don't know about you, but when I was a kid growing up, and I still feel it now, I've seen wonderful things. I've seen deserts. I've seen great cities. I've seen magicians doing incredible tricks. I've seen the Grand Canyon. But I look up at the stars and a full heaven of stars. Is there anything like that? To fill your heart with wonder at the mystery of it all. And before I even knew the name of God, I looked out and I just thought, there's something more to all of this. No scientist can ever satisfy something I sense in my heart when I look out and I just say, this is just out there somewhere. It's in the stars when I felt that most powerfully. It's nothing new. The ancient mariners, they found their way through the seas looking for the stars. The Arabs in the desert, they can see the stars in the daytime, you know. They're so attuned to the stars, even in the bright desert sun, they can look up into the heavens and they can still see the stars and find their way and they take their bearings. It's amazing, isn't it? I'm told, I don't know if it's true, but if you get underneath a chimney and you look up through a very, very tall chimney, even in the daytime you can see the stars. Or you go down into a well and look up. Somebody just said that the other day. They're always there, aren't they? The stars are always there. Even if you don't see them, they are always there. And they've provided guidance to people spiritually and just practically, practical guidance down through the ages. And the Lord has put them there. Balaam, son of Beor, was a great soothsayer, a magician, and he had the ability to give prophecies and foretell things. And people would hire him to come along and give them a reading. And these people wanted, they were in trouble. They saw the Israelites coming their way and they thought that they might invade their land. So they asked this guy to prophesy and give them a reading. And he looked up into the whatever spirit he was channeling. And he saw the people of Israel and he saw a star rising up out of them. The star arising out of Jacob. And he basically turned around and said, I don't think you should mess with these people. There's a king coming from these people. You don't want to offend these people. Stay on the right side of these people. And that star is the star that the later generations, the Magi, the astronomers, the astrologers, the, I don't know what the name of all the star sign folks are, but they saw it, didn't they? In later years, they saw a star rising up in the east and they followed it and they followed it. They knew this was Jacob's star. They knew the prophecy was coming to pass. They followed it and they came to that stable and there they found Jesus. The bright shining star, Jesus. In Revelation, John tells us that the spirit that Jesus gives us is described as the morning star. There's a theme here. Have you picked that up? The spirit is described as the morning star. The morning star, I don't suspect many of you see the morning star. It rises about 3 a.m. But in our world, everything revolves around the sun, doesn't it? When the sun comes up, the day starts. But in the east, where it's a lot hotter than it is today, you start at 3 a.m., you get up early. You beat the sun. You don't want to be around when the sun's around. You work hard from 3 a.m. onwards, maybe through till 11 or something like that. When you have to go inside and rest and have some food, and then you come out when the evening starts. And the morning star says the work is beginning. And so when he sends the morning star into your hearts, the spirit begins to work in you. The work of God is beginning in your lives. It's beginning in your hearts. It's a sign, isn't it? God is at work when he sends his spirit into your life. The ancient world didn't revolve around the sun. The sun was something you avoided. The stars were really crucial. You know, on the Sabbath, people worked all the way through the week, didn't they? And it wasn't at sunset that the day was over. It was the moment you saw the first star. And they would appoint somebody whose job and responsibility it was to, when the first star arose in the sky, they would point to it and say, the star has arisen. And the greatest joy was, of course, on Friday when the Sabbath begins. On Friday evening, as the first star appeared in the sky, somebody whose sole religious responsibility was to stand on the walls. And when the star was seeing, okay, the Sabbath has begun. I'm sorry. I get excited, Sandy, you know that. We'll have a moment of rest. The Sabbath has begun. Work is done. Down your tools. People, it's time to worship. When the new star, that evening star, arises, it's time to come. It's time to worship. That's why it says in Genesis chapter 1, the evening and the morning was the first day. The day begins in the evening when the star appears and goes on through the night. That's the first. You begin with rest and then you work based on the rest that God has given you the night before. And then you work through until the star appears again in the evening. I'm saying all this, aren't I? Because it says in chapter 2, verse 15, that we are called to shine like stars. We're called to shine like stars. That's the theme that I'm picking up on here from the scriptures. And there's a lot of significance resting on that. That's the point I'm trying to make. But when are you most aware of the stars? You're most aware of the stars when it gets dark. When the darkness begins to encroach, when it begins to fall, when life you can't work, when it becomes more complicated, more involved, you become more restricted. At those times, the stars become brighter and brighter and brighter, don't they? And Paul is writing to them at a time when the darkness is beginning to fall. And he's saying to them, as the darkness falls, the stars have always been shining. They shine right through the day. You just don't see them. But as the darkness falls, he's saying, you just carry on shining. Because as it gets darker and darker, so your light will appear more and more brightly. Shine, shine. What, in the 1950s, 1960s, we don't call them that so much anymore. What do we call a celebrity, a film actor? Stars, right? Stars. As far as Paul is concerned, when he looks around, there was, you know, you don't think there weren't sort of superstars, as it were, in the ancient world, famous singers and athletes. Of course there were, nothing. But as far as he's concerned, in this culture of celebrity we're living in at the moment, as far as he's concerned, you know who the celebrities are? You know who the stars are? People who will shine for Jesus when it gets dark. When it gets tough and they still shine. That's his view of somebody worth celebrating. It's a much more searching criteria, isn't it, of character and substance than perhaps we might give out so very casually today. Real stars, when things are tough and you shine, that's something to celebrate. That's somebody to celebrate as far as he's concerned. The verse 14, 12 through to 14, look in there for just a moment, and you'll see that this shining doesn't just come about by accident. There's something purposeful. There's something deliberate. There are things they must do. In verse 12, they must obey. They've been obeying. They've got to carry on obeying. Keep trusting God's direction in your life. And as they do that, as they obey God, they meet with God who is working in their lives. God is working all the time and his plans will never be frustrated, but we experience partnership with God when we're walking in obedience. Fellowship with God when we're walking in obedience. He's not planing against the grain, he's with the grain. So much work gets done. It's such a smooth work, isn't it? What a joy it is when we're walking in obedience. Do you know the peace and the joy inside when you know that you're walking in obedience as compared to the times, let's face it, when we're not? He's encouraging them, isn't he? Obey, because as you obey, you're with God as he works. In verse 14, the truth is that as it gets tougher, as it gets harder, and obeying God, you see, it's quite easy to obey God when things are going well, but what's happening is things are getting tougher, and he's saying to them, the danger is that as it gets tougher, your joyful obedience will turn to a grumbling and complaining obedience, a dutiful obedience. Oh, if I have to, if I must. You've got to break that. You've got to break that and find the joy. Find that joy. Because in that, if you will do that when it's tough, you will shine, Christians. You'll stand out. And there will be consequences. Verses 15 through to 18 starts with, so that there are consequences. If you live like this, there will be it will have an effect. Verse 15, there's a kind of a sense that that will be perfecting the work that God is doing in your life. You will end up blameless, faultless, pure, shining bright like a star. I don't think this is teaching sinless perfection, by the way. But I do think it's teaching holy life. You know, we talk about checking over the aeroplanes for hairline cracks. It's nice when you've checked it over. There are no cracks. Fly. We're made to fly. By this, we're made to shine. We're made to be out there. Out there, seen. Especially when it's tough. And in verse 16, we see that if they will do that, and they will commit themselves to this, he will be given something that will give him such peace and such satisfaction. Paul will be able to look at the work that he's done over these former 10 years at the church that he founded and planted and loved and nurtured and served and suffered for and sent people to support and prayed for and cared about. And at the end of it, he'll be able to say, look at them. Look at them. Look how they're going on with God. This isn't me. It's you. You've been working in their lives. And I've been your servant, your partner in this. How I rejoice. How I rejoice to see they are going on not with me, but with you, Lord. Verse 17. You know, it has been tough. Ministry is tough. What did Neil said yesterday about how many pastors have wanted to jump on a boat to Tarshish and send the other direction. It's in all of our lives, isn't it? There's the temptation, the voice. Oh, oh, oh. But Nineveh calls. Nineveh calls. The call is there in all of our lives. And he's saying, if I will see you shining and living for God, I will be able to go and leave you and go to heaven. And I will be able to go in peace looking back at all the labors. And I'll say, it wasn't for nothing that I gave my life to these people. I wasn't wasting my time. The sacrifices I made weren't in vain. Doesn't your heart just cry out for those people in those countries who they plant, they water, they work in the midday sun, they get nothing for their labors but poverty? You know, I was saying to the people this morning, you know, I used to drive over to Winchester years and years and years ago, and there were big, big oceans of fields, and they used to plant all this grain in there, and it'd be growing up. I don't know, it's a beautiful sight, especially when just before it turns gold, and it's that almost like a long grass, and the wind blows in it, and it looks like an ocean, and all this harvest just coming up, just to see the harvest coming up. And when it turns gold, wow. You know, the farmers must get some real satisfaction. And he has served long and hard, and he's looking to see a harvest. And he knows that he's very likely going to die. And in fact, the Apostle Paul died within a few months, probably, of writing this letter. He faced his final executioner. And he wanted them, in verse 18, to look at that death not as a dark thing, as an end, but to rejoice that he'd served them, he'd served God, he'd achieved what he set out to do. And he wanted that day of darkness, even that, to shine. The way we live our lives matters. And it has an effect on the people around us. The people who serve us, they care about your souls. It matters. And the end of all of our service is rejoicing in the end, isn't it? That we would have really good cause at the end to be glad, to say it was good, to say that God is good and he is being good to us. But it doesn't come cheap. It doesn't come light. I'm no expert in astrophysics, but I'm told that the formation of a star is quite a remarkable thing. All these nebulous gases and space dust begin to form within themselves a kind of gravitational pull. And these things begin to create a mass. And the gravity begins to increase by some process I don't pretend to understand. But I know that what happens is these gases and these dust get concertinaed and crushed in by the gravity until there is no molecular space left for them to remain independent, separate things, disconnected from another, floating around nebulously in the universe. But their atomic structures become so concertinaed and crushed that eventually nuclear fusion takes place. And at a subatomic level, the very structures of their very essence and being, they can no longer cease to be gases moving nebulously around, but are crushed into
mass and substance and form, and they become a star. And the release of energy, the nuclear explosion of energy, is what we see when we look up in the sky and see these vast mass nuclear explosions taking place in space. Stars are born out of intense pressure. As you sustain intense pressure, so your light shines. I have no idea who's going to win this afternoon. But I'd be very, very surprised, very, very surprised, if we listen to the post-match discussions and the word pressure isn't mentioned once. You know, you're not going to win Wimbledon without having taken 77 years of British indignity resting on Murray's shoulders today. No pressure. Do you think he is under pressure? And if he can withstand that pressure, and instead of collapsing in on himself and becoming a black hole, he finds the constructive strength to become a solid mass of power that will enable him to bear that pressure up, bounce that ball back, and win and become the star of Wimbledon. I'm telling you, it hasn't come about without pressure. Pressure that's been on him, not just today, but for years and years and years and years and years and years and years. But if he wins, you better believe he's going to shine. He's going to shine. So as Christians, if you're facing any measure of pressure, think of the glory. Think of the brightness. Think of what God is doing in your lives. You may not see it. He sees it. He knows what he is doing. Look at them all. I know it's daytime, but they're there. Look at them all. He knows how to do a thing, you know. He knows how to do a thing. And from verse 12, the fact is that this group of Christians in Philippi have been doing really well. They have been obedient. But actually, it's been in the daytime. Things have been relatively good. And he sees that darkness is falling and they're going to have to press in and take God's word even more seriously than they have in the past. Be more careful to be obedient than they were even before. Because the truth is, the support structures, the scaffolding is coming off their lives. Paul has been there from the beginning, nurturing them, helping them, teaching them, encouraging them, praying for them, a covering. But as the pressure comes on, he's being separated off from them. He's now in prison. He can't just come round and see them. Luke has been withdrawn. The teaching ministry, all that sort of thing has been withdrawn from their life. The pressure is on Paul. He is in chains. He can't do what he wants to do. He can't help them the way he used to help them. They're going to have to stand on their own two feet. Maturity. They are going to have to shine. If they don't do it, it won't happen. He can't shine for them. He's shining in his place. It won't happen. And that's what's happening. And the rub of the verse in verse 12, we tend to emphasize serving God in fear and trembling. But if you look at the way that verse is actually structured, it begins with the word continue. They're already serving God in fear and trembling, working out their salvation in fear and trembling. But they've got to carry on. Keep going. Don't give up. If it becomes difficult, don't give up. Don't give up. The fear and trembling thing, I think, relates to Isaiah chapter 66, verse 2, when it's written there, this is God speaking. Hear this. This is wonderful. These are the ones I look upon with favor. Those who are humble and contrite and broken in spirit, who tremble at my word. That's what's been in them. That's the kind of people they were. Now they've just got to carry on being that, whatever is up ahead, whatever the future holds. And as we go into verse 13, we mention that as they continue to have that attitude to God's word and desire to be obedient, God will meet them in that place. How many of you have ever been invited to a party? Things have changed with sat-nav, but in the olden days, the good old days, you get lost, didn't you? People used to get lost all the time. There's no excuse for being lost anymore now we've got sat-nav. People always say to you, but what about sat-nav? But the worst bit of every journey was the last bit. You'd be able to get the motorway, and you get onto the motorway, and then you do the next bit, and the A roads and the B roads, and you get down to the town. You'd find the town, and you'd probably find the part of the town, because there'd be a sign. And then finding that second turning on the right, just past the roundabout, and there's the blue house on the corner, all that stuff. That's where the problems start to happen. Imagine you've been invited to a party. Imagine you went on the journey, and you set off on journey. With the best will in the world, if you didn't find the house, if you didn't finally arrive, if you didn't get there, if you didn't see it through, even if you chaps had to stop and ask for some directions, whatever it cost, if you didn't get to that front door and walk in through, you didn't get to eat cake, did you? Right? You don't get to eat the cake unless you actually see it through to the end. You've got to see it through. And that's what it is, doing God's will. He's doing a work in us. He started a work in us. He's working out his good pleasure. We've got to stay in step with him right through to the end, till it's completed, till it's finished. And if verse 14 wasn't so serious, I think we'd find it quite funny as we almost perhaps laugh at ourselves about all our mumbling and groanings and complainings. I wonder what Djokovic's body is feeling like. He played 5 hours of tennis yesterday. We sang his Walter's body hurting after an hour in the sun yesterday playing football. You know, as the pressure is on, as the demands are on, it hurts. It hurts. No pain, no gain, right? That's when you know you're getting somewhere very often. But what starts to creep out is the complaints, the mumblings, the complaining. Because it's all right when God is asking us to do something that essentially we're quite happy to do, and we're just going on with God, and it's all quite convenient. It's when he starts to ask us to do things, and really, truthfully, it is getting costly, it is getting expensive, it's becoming hard. This might actually, as these men people are facing, they might cost them their lives. You know, keep going, keep going. Don't give up. Don't give up. Don't give up. And they're all, it's some sort of reference, I think, to the mumbling and complaining in the wilderness, because very shortly after this, as he starts to make these promises to them in verse 15 about what the consequence will be if they'll just keep going, as they stand out in this warped and crooked generation, he's quoting from Moses there, Deuteronomy 32 verse 5, when he sings this song. You know the song of Moses? Have you read that, Stuart? The song of Moses? He liked to sing. And in the song of Moses, he sings this song all about what it's like to be leading a group of people to follow after God, and people are bailing out left, right, and center, and giving up, and they're turning back, and grumbling, and mumbling, and complaining, you know? The joys of ministry. And it's a rebuke against those who give up. Give up. Don't give up. Don't give up. Daniel chapter 12 verse 1 and 3 is also being quoted here. At that time, says Daniel in the prophecy, the time of Michael, a great prince who protects his people, will arise. That must be Jesus. And there will be a time of much distress, such as not happened from the beginning of the nations until then. But at that time, everybody whose name is written in the Lamb's Book of Life will be delivered, and multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. And those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and will lead many to righteousness, like the stars, forever and forever. You know, when it's dark, that's when your testimony will count. Well, people will see you and they will stop and they will wonder. And they will get direction in the darkness. But as we go on to verse 16, it's about holding firm to God's word. That's what we're being asked to do. Just hang on to God's word. Let's round up. Remember the Sabbath watchman on the walls? I see Paul here like a Sabbath watchman on the walls. He's seen the Philippians. He knows what's going on in their lives. But he's waiting to see, as the darkness falls, whether they will pop up on the horizon like little stars. Whether they will press on and continue. Because the moment he sees that sign, that as the pressure is on, they press in, he will know that his work is over. And that he can go to be with his Lord in peace. And that his Sabbath, he'll be able to enter his Sabbath, knowing that they, a new day is beginning to dawn, and that they are going to go on with God. And in verse 17, they talks about the drink offering, him being poured out. He anticipates some terrible situation where he will lose his life. And he sees them as well in the same peril. He talks about their lives being like a meat offering being poured. We looked at this in Leviticus, didn't we? A meat offering and the wine being poured over it and all being offered up to God. Something is going on in their lives. He actually anticipates them all somehow being consumed in some dreadful holocaust. And he's calling them to live their lives for God and die their deaths for him also and live outstanding lives at the most difficult of days. And you know, within months of writing this, the Emperor Nero accused the Christian community of having set fire to the city of Rome. And do you know what he did to the Christians? He crucified them through the streets of Rome. And he covered their bodies with pitch and tar. And he set fire to them at night and illuminated the streets. He made them like shining stars at night. And he sent them into the arenas to face the lions. You know the stories about Christians and the lions? These people, this is where it started. And he's writing a word of preparation for them. And you can see why these people stood the way they did. Why we're talking about them 2,000 years later. Why the world knows how Christians faced their persecutors and overcame, not with force of arms, but force of spirit. How they stood out, how they faced the lions with a prayer. And they would not renounce their faith. And you know that Romans honestly thought that they would just provide a lot of more entertainment for the Roman citizens and this would all be very laughable. And people didn't like Christians. I mean, let's face it, if the master is hated, they will hate you also. And people hated Christians. But the day they actually started to see their neighbors and their slaves and their colleagues being thrown to the lions and not renouncing their faith, you know, the Roman crowds watched on this spectacle and we read reports of how they were horrified by what they saw. And this great PR exercise rather backfired. And thousands and thousands of people became Christians. There are stories of one Roman governor who had a knock on his door from a group of people, quite a large group of people, saying, "We too are Christians and we know you are persecuting us. And you're throwing our compatriots into the arenas to be fed by the lions. Why have our lives been so inconspicuous that you have allowed us to continue to live out our peace? We are here to offer ourselves. We are Christians." And he duly obliged by taking some of their lives. And the others cried out, "We are still here." He says, "Aren't there ropes and cliffs to jump off that you can't take your own lives if you desire death?" He could not. It collapsed. It crushed him. The boldness of Christians. "There is only one. I am the way, the truth, and the life," said Jesus. "Nobody comes to the Father except by me. When push comes to shove, They shone. They shone. All right, I'm done. It's still daytime. It's not dark, is it? Does that mean you don't have to shine? No, they stars shine day and night. But if it begins to get dark, will you still shine? Think of people right now where it is dark. And we know about them because they are shining. Let's not forget them. Let's not forget them and make sure that we are also mindful of these things ourselves.